The Fortis or Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Peter C. Kavanaugh presiding.
Thank you and good morning. The first call 4-23-0771, People of the State of Illinois versus Alex J. Sandoval. Counsel for the appellant, would you please state your name for the record?
Emma Poorman, P as in Peter, Oormann.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
David Manchin.
Thank you. Ms. Poorman, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Emma Poorman from the Office of the State Appellate Defender, arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Alexander J. Sandoval, who seeks reversal of his misdemeanor conviction for violating the Firearm Concealed Carry Act. Given my limited time, I plan to rest on my brief for the second and third arguments, but I will, of course, discuss those issues if the court requires any further argumentation or clarification. I will first begin with the fourth argument that we provided through the supplemental brief. I believe that this case turns on a key question. Did the state fail to prove Sandoval guilty where it presented no evidence that he was a licensee under the act? Now, the Firearm Concealed Carry Act makes it a misdemeanor for a, quote, licensee defined as a person issued a license to carry a concealed handgun, to carry a concealed firearm while under the influence of alcohol. Simply put, the state did not prove at any time that Sandoval possessed a concealed carry license, and that's something that I understand the state even acknowledges. The act, of course, regulates concealed carry in Illinois, and a plain reading suggests that this violation only applies to licensees and not the general public. Because it specifically utilizes that defined term of licensee. Further support for this is in that same violation section. We see the term firearm instructors and licensees used, and the only time the general public is referenced, they use the generic term persons under subsection H to refer to individuals who simply applied for a license, indicating again that this is a statute that applies only to licensees. As this court is aware, recently the Supreme Court touched on this issue in People v. Harvey. In the facts in that case, Harvey was convicted of unlawful use of a weapon without a CCL. And the court ultimately found that the evidence was sufficient to support a finding that the defendant had not been issued a valid CCL, that evidence being Harvey's own out-of-court statements. But of note is that the Supreme Court rejected an argument from the state that I think provides us with some guidance here. The state argued that they were not required to show that Harvey had not been issued a currently valid CCL, instead stating that the fact that he didn't present one was sufficient. The Supreme Court rejected that, and I'm specifically looking at paragraph 16, by suggesting that that's refuted by the plain language of the Carry Act. It reads, in section 70F of the Carry Act, the legislature specifically exempted any person who has a valid CCL from prosecution under the applicable section of the UUW statute. It follows, therefore, that the only individuals who could potentially face liability under the applicable section are those persons who do not have a valid CCL. So what this suggests, again, is that these statutes can apply to one group and not the other. And in Harvey, that would be non-CCL owners versus CCL owners. And here we're looking at licensee versus non-licensee. So similar to Harvey, because the state didn't present any evidence while they did in Harvey, that Sandoval had the license, the state failed to prove a key element of the offense because the statute exclusively regulates the behavior of CCL owners.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? So what about the fact on this issue with regard to the jury instructions? Because the state's instructions were rejected, defendant presented the two instructions on the carry conceal, and it didn't have anything in those instructions regarding defendant being a licensee.
So when it comes to the jury instructions, the instructions conference and those suggested jury instructions, what they indicate to me is that the parties were primarily focused on the issue of intoxication and how to prove that and how to describe that to the jury. I think there's some indication as a result that, you know, perhaps everyone dropped the ball on this, that neither party was really intuited the fact that this really only applies to licensees. But regardless, it's still a sufficiency issue that is solely the burden of the state. And as a result, while yes, those jury instructions did not include that language, they simply stated a person rather than licensee. There isn't the kind of affirmative acquiescence that you would typically see in a case involving, waiver or invited error. That being said, I think the sufficiency of evidence simply can't be waived, which is the key issue here. But if the court,
And that wasn't challenged in your brief. Sufficiency of the evidence was not raised in any post-trial motions.
Your Honor, considering that this was a key element of the offense, that it only applies to licensees, I don't believe waiver applies, and I think that the cases Wilson and Everett support as much, that that's something that we can raise at any time, including in our appellate briefs. And even if that is the case, I do ask that this court review this issue under plain error.
Okay.
If there are no further questions on that, I would like to move on to my next argument.
I think we're good. Go ahead.
Thank you. Turning to argument one, should this court reject the argument that the state failed to prove the essential element of whether or not Sandoval was a licensee, a fundamental question still remains. The act defines concealed firearm as a loaded or unloaded handgun carried on or about a person, completely or mostly concealed from view of the public or on about a person within a vehicle, which leads us to that central question of was Sandoval carrying that handgun on or about his person when he was found in the driver's seat of the car? I suggest that a plain reading of the statute and concealed carry precedent extending back 100 years confirmed that he was not. When the police found Sandoval, he again was in the driver's seat with that firearm located underneath the front passenger seat. And in order to reach that firearm, he would have necessarily had to lean sideways and bend forward. That is, if he could have reached that firearm at all, that wasn't discussed at trial. Central to our understanding of concealed carry are these two older cases, Liss and Nemeth. And Liss and Nemeth suggest that for a firearm to be on or about a person within a vehicle, it must be so placed that it can be accessed without appreciable change in the position of the owner. Liss is a very similar case dealing with a very similar statute. That statute being no person shall carry concealed on or about his person a pistol, revolver, or firearm. And given the similar facts, Liss remarks, it requires no great wisdom to know it's impossible to reach a pistol under the front seat of the car without changing position at the wheel. It's necessary to bend forward to reach under the seat, which again would be the case here. Mr. Sandoval would have had to necessarily have leaned forward and bend over to reach that firearm under that front passenger seat.
Well, does it depend on how far under the seat the gun is? Right? I mean, how far back the seat is? There's just a lot of factual elements to that conclusion, and it seems as though you're drawing only one.
I would say a few things in response to that. One is that appreciable change in position. The facts in Liss are very, very similar. And I think that phrase, no great wisdom, provides us with significant guidance here. Reaching a firearm underneath the driver's seat is very similar to reaching a firearm underneath that front passenger seat. I think they're directly analogous. And for that reason, I think it's appropriate to draw that conclusion. And in terms of whether this was a factual conclusion or a legal conclusion, I think it's interesting that the jury intuited this issue by asking the trial court, is it a violation of the concealed carry law to have a weapon in your vehicle as opposed to on your person? So the jury was really struggling to even know what the legal standard was. They weren't concerned about the facts. It was not disputed that the firearm was underneath that front passenger seat. What they were struggling to understand was, if that firearm is anywhere within the vehicle, does that meet the standard? So it's really a legal question that we're left with here rather than a factual one.
But didn't you, or not you, I'm sorry, defense counsel agree with responding to that jury question and you sent back on or about? The original instruction says on the person, but then when you answered the question, it said on or about the person.
The on or about person language, again, under the context of Liss and Nemeth, also has this additional element about not changing position and being accessed without appreciable change in the position of the owner. So in that way, I think it was insufficient to answer the jury's question.
Yep.
Did the state have a higher burden of proof than simply demonstrating that Sandoval had a firearm underneath that front passenger seat? The state failed to meet the burden of demonstrating that Sandoval carried the firearm on or about his person within the vehicle, and his conviction should therefore be reversed. I'd also note that if this court rejects our contention that there's a difference between carry and possess, I'd also like to point out that it's differentiated within the act itself. In the section regulating the possession of firearms in the home, it says that a licensee shall possess a license at all times, except when the licensee is carrying or possessing a concealed firearm on his or her land. Again, the addition of the word possess here suggesting that it's more expansive, while carrying is going to have that close to the body language. With that, if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
I just have one question. Do you know how the jury was instructed with respect to the licensee issue in the recent case in People versus Harvey?
I don't, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Right. There being no further questions, Mr. Manchin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I think defense counsel correct that the key issue in this case is the licensee language in the statute. I agree that as written, the statute seems to apply only to concealed carry licensees. And I don't think that was the legislature's intent, but I do not believe it should be applied in this case. This is a case of invited error and affirmative acquiescence on the defendant's part. It was the defendant who requested the jury to be instructed as the elements of defense, only possessing the gun and being intoxicated. Having taken an affirmative position that that was the only two elements of the offense, it is entirely improper for him to now say, "Oops, I messed up. Therefore I get to go free." And plain error cannot apply to an instance of invited error. I think counsel is correct that this is a situation where everybody dropped the ball down below, that nobody noticed the invitee language. And I note that counsel on appeal didn't even notice this until week before this case was scheduled for argument the first time. So it's a case where a defendant is trying to take advantage of his own mistake and his own position in the trial court. And I submit that that is entirely improper. With respect to the other issues raised, the question of was the defendant carrying the gun is a factual question. It's a factual question that was resolved against the defendant by the jury, and there's simply no basis for this court to disturb that verdict.
All right, well,
The
let me break in there, Mr. Manchin.
okay.
Can you discuss, distinguish, rectify, list with the facts in this case?
Yes, Liss was a case where there were two people in the car. The defendant and the passenger both denied having the gun. The defendant had borrowed the car from somebody else. So that is factually distinguishable. But here, the defendant's in the car by himself. He has a loaded magazine on his person, and he tells the police that the gun is in the car. So the problem in Liss was the defendant was not shown to have knowledge of the presence of the gun in the car. Here we have clear evidence that the defendant knew the gun was in the car, based upon both the magazine on his person and his statement, the gun's in the car. Plus, as I recall, there was testimony that he was seen moving around in the car prior to the time the police walked up to the car. suggestion that was when he slipped it underneath the seat. And as far as on or about, a carry, by definition, means it can be just in the car. It doesn't have to be on the defendant. In fact, the one case cited by the defendant, I believe it was Nemeth, said that a person could be convicted of carrying a concealed weapon was pushed behind the cushion of the car on which the defendant was sitting when it's lying at the defendant's feet or concealed on a seat. So carrying, just being in the car is carrying it. So the answer to the jury's
The courts seem to make some distinction on this passenger seat issue and whether or not it's readily accessible, do they not?
I believe in Nemeth, it was not under the seat. It was in the back seat, 10 feet away from the defendant, with defendant's testimony that he had no knowledge of the gun, which is slightly different than a defendant admitting the gun's there and it's right under the front seat. And I cite in my brief several other cases discussing when gun can be on or about a person, where it's the one case was even in the front motor compartment of the car, and the court said, yeah, that's on or about being carried on or about the person. So that this very narrow definition that defendant wants to adopt as a matter of law is incorrect. He can be found guilty of carrying it, even if it's underneath the seat of the car rather than right next to him on the seat of the car. And as far as the counsel's response to the jury's question, I think that was a reasonable one. His whole contention at trial was that the gun had to actually be on the defendant. And seeking the a further definition of on or about would have been contrary to that theory, so his decision to how to answer that question, I think, was not ineffective assistance. And I question the validity of relying on jury's questions to determine the sufficiency of the evidence, because as your court is aware, the jury asks all sorts of questions, and we really don't know why or what the questions mean. So to hang a determination that there's a reasonable doubt of guilt based upon their question, I think is incorrect, especially when the jury, having asked the question and having received the proper instructions, enters a verdict. The question of is he carrying the gun is simply a factual one decided against him. It's not a gun under the passenger seat cannot be said as a matter of law, not being carried by the defendant. So it
Mr.
comes
Manchin,
down.
can I
Yeah.
bring you back to that first issue for just a minute?
Yes.
Your contention about it being invited error has to do with the fact that the defendant tendered jury instructions that did not mention the license or the absence of a CCL license.
He also argued that the only elements were that it had to be on the defendant
Argued at
at trial.
both of those things happened after the close of evidence, right?
Correct.
The jury instruction conference happened after evidence was closed. Argument happens after evidence is closed, correct?
Correct.
So if the issue is the sufficiency of the evidence, the instructions had nothing to do with it. If the state never put in evidence of his lack of a CCL license, then even if the instructions had been correct, we'd be in the same boat. You just don't have the evidence to prove that he was guilty of this offense.
You're correct, Your Honor, but I'm suggesting that the defendant was, his entire position throughout the trial was that the only elements of the offense were having the gun and being intoxicated,
Right,
and
but you cannot, you can't.
inviting the error that occurred. So I'm just,
No, but where's the error? I don't think there's an error. Sufficiency of the evidence is its own thing. There is no trial court error. Sufficiency of the evidence can't be waived. So what difference does it make if the wrong instructions were given when it's clear, looking at the evidence, you didn't have what you needed to prove him guilty?
You're correct, Your Honor. I'm just saying that it's sort of a matter of equity that
But you
I
agree,
know
right?
I agree that as the statute is written, the only way it can be interpreted is it applies solely to concealed carry people with concealed carry licenses, and I don't think that's what the legislature intended, but that's
But
where we are.
that's your concession, and that seems to be the message from Harvey. So the fact that the instructions were right, wrong, or indifferent doesn't cure the sufficiency of the evidence.
I agree.
Okay.
So if there are no further questions, thank you, honors.
Thank you. I see no questions. Rebuttal, Ms. Foreman?
I believe our case, our reply brief sufficiently addresses the state's attempts to distinguish Liss and Nemeth. I would also suggest that the state raised the issue of knowledge, which, of course, is a lack of knowledge can be defense in a possessory crime, but it's not an element here. This isn't a constructive possession case. It's essentially irrelevant that Mr. Sandoval knew that there was a firearm in the vehicle. But just returning to this issue of jury instructions, again, I think that cases of Wilson and Everett are instructive. Particularly Wilson, an indictment charging a defendant with felony retail alleged the defendant had a prior conviction for retail theft, but the prior theft was never proved as an element of trial. Ultimately, the court in Wilson determined that failure to prove a material allegation beyond a reasonable doubt is fatal to the judgment of conviction. The question may be raised for the first time upon review. I think that's directly analogous here. This is a key element that Sandoval was a licensee, and ultimately the failure to instruct the jury on that matter is irrelevant. So I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Sandoval's conviction on that basis.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and now is in recess.